Hey everyone, it's me, W. Kamau Bell. Welcome to another round of the ACLU's podcast, At Liberty. Air horn. Anyway, every episode I'm asking the big questions on the big issues affecting our country and especially our hardest hit and most vulnerable communities. And I'm calling on ACLU experts for guidance because we need experts to help. This year so far, we've heard from the ACLU's Cecilia Wong and Shay Strangio. Check those episodes out after you listen to this one. They shared so many relevant insights into Trump's executive orders and the current state of the LGBTQIA plus rights community and beyond. Today, we're taking on one of the biggest issues affecting our country. So big, in fact, that we need two guests to help us make sense of things. Yeah, we're talking immigrants' rights. We know things are moving quickly, so for folks keeping track, we're recording this episode on Monday, February 24th, and as of today, here's the latest. President Trump has issued an executive order to eliminate birthright citizenship, which the ACLU challenged in court hours after it was announced. Communities are currently facing increased raids and actions by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, aka ICE. The Trump administration is currently using remote locations like Guantanamo to detain immigrants who are cut off from lawyers, families, and resources. Thankfully, the ACLU is trying to change that. All right. As always, let's take a breath. We got this. You got this. And the ACLU's got you, too. Ooh, that should be a T-shirt. Now let's get into it. Our first guest is the ACLU's National Director of Immigrant Community Strategies, and she's a member of my Special Correspondent Task Force. She's joining us today to talk through the advocacy piece of immigration rights. Please welcome back to the show, Maribel Hernandez-Rivera. I'm going to ask the most difficult question. How are you doing?
It's a really rough moment. I am fired up to be fighting for immigrant rights, to be at the ACLU at this moment, to do everything that we can do. I am also in a moment where my community and my family is directly impacted with what's happening. So there are feelings of fear. There are feelings of sadness to see how the community is being treated at this moment. And there's also a feeling of resiliency. And it was interesting, Kamau, because you mentioned, you know, you started with thank you for your service. It always makes me think of my brother, who after 22 years in the U.S. Navy, just retired last year in October. So he actually did military service. And to think that he himself is worried about these immigration policies at the moment just breaks my heart.
Yeah, we did work an episode of United Shades about the idea that you can literally be fight for this country and that doesn't come with citizenship or any protections after you serve for this country.
Yeah, or protections for your loved ones, for your family members. Yeah, it's hard.
I can't imagine how hard it is. I think we're all going through different aspects of this current era of America and how it's different for us and how it impacts us. There's been a lot of talk about immigrants and undocumented folks and, you know, I know you're not just doing this work, as you alluded to, because you feel compelled to do it. It also touches your life. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it touches my life in many ways. I come from a mixed status family. My husband himself has something called temporary protected status. Now, he has been in the country for more than 20 years. He has had temporary protected status for more than 20 years. We have been married for 15. And despite all of those roots, all those relationships with the community, he's in danger. Now, we have seen under this administration, they ended temporary protected status for people from Venezuela. So what that really means is that they have made people who had documentation undocumented so they can have more people to deport. So they did that. They also have announced that they will now no longer really go forward with the temporary protected status that had been given to Haiti until 2026. It will now end in 2025. So I say this because we know that temporary protected status is in peril. It was, in fact, attacked during the first Trump administration, and here we are again. And so knowing that I have a husband with temporary protected status, I remember the first Trump administration, we had talks about what do we do if, or what do we do when? And here we are again. And like I said, it's a threat that is constantly looming over us.
Yeah, I think one of the things we did an episode of the United States about the Venezuelan community in Southern Florida, and many of those people were supporters of this administration and thought they were voting for an administration that had their back. And then to find out very quickly that their back was not had it's tragic.
Yes, we have seen many communities who voted for this administration because they thought they would be spared. They thought they would be okay. They thought it wasn't going to be them. And now we're seeing, and that's what we've been saying at the ACLU, that when civil rights and civil liberties are threatened for one group, they're threatened for everybody. It affects all of us. And just as easily as we can go after one group, we will go after everybody, which is why the ACLU really protects civil rights and civil liberties for everyone, because that really determines how it's going to be playing out for the rest of us. So yes, we currently have, I don't think people thought that you would have a president who would be making deals with Maduro in Venezuela, right? But that's exactly what's happening. So it's a really hard moment. And I think it's a moment when people are realizing what that rhetoric meant, because I think that's the big thing. When it's words, people don't really understand what that means. When people say mass deportations, that might not mean anything to anybody. But when we see bakeries being raided, when we see people being picked up at school and being taken by ICE from hospitals, from courthouses, that's when we see what that means and how harmful it is to all of our communities.
I can't imagine everything going on there and everything you have to do. Can you just talk about like what a typical day in your work life looks like, if there is such a thing as a typical day?
So there is definitely not a typical day, but I will say that the most typical of my day is just being in community with people who are ready and willing to fight, ready and willing to stand up to injustices, and we are ready and willing to do anything that we can. So that is a constant, and for that, I'm grateful. Now, in terms of my day-to-day work, that changes. You know, it's been a month. It's just been a month since the Trump administration took over. And basically, we have had a constant attack of our immigrant communities, one policy after another. And what's so interesting is that many of these policies are unconstitutional. You know, we are seeing courts again and again saying, no, this goes against the Constitution. But I think what's really important for people to note, and we said it and we've been saying it for a while, is that this administration could care less about the laws. And most important, you know, the most important law in the United States is the U.S. Constitution. And even then, this administration is disregarding it completely. And so, you know, day after day, we see a policy after policy that is unconstitutional, that's unlawful, that is cruel, that's inhumane, all of those at the same time. And so my day to day looks like, you know, we often get reached out by the press saying, what's happening? Please explaining that, reaching out to impacted communities. I can tell you when people were being sent to Guantanamo, I got phone calls from mothers in other countries reaching out to the ACLU because they did not know what was happening to their loved ones. They had stopped communicating with their loved ones because the people in Guantanamo didn't have communication with their lawyers, didn't have communication with their family members. And here were the mothers crying, desperate. They're saying, I don't know what's going to happen to my family member. What can I do? And so that was really heartbreaking to have a mother on the other side of the phone and say, I don't know either. I don't know what's happening because there's a lack of transparency. There's a lack of accountability. But at the very least, what I could say is, but I can't tell you we're fighting. I can't tell you our team is all in and we are going to not allow this to go unnoticed. So that I could say, but even then it was just very difficult talking to the mothers of these impacted individuals. Mm.
Can you talk about people think of the ACLU as a group of lawyers, but you're really on the advocacy side of this issue. Can you talk about the difference between the work of the legal work versus what you're doing in advocacy?
Definitely. So I went to law school and I went to law school because I wanted to protect immigrant rights. Because when my father passed away, his rights were violated. Nobody ever told us that he had passed away.
Oh my God.
So that's what sent me into this advocacy world. But what's really exciting about the ACLU is that one way to fight back is going to the courts, and it's a very important way. But there's also many other ways. So other ways are being on the streets and raising our voices. Individuals are really important. In fact, at the ACLU, we have an arm that is called People Power, because it truly is because of people power that we will be able to defeat policies is what we're seeing. That's one way. The other is working with Congress. There's still congressional allies. There's still people who want to do right. And so we need them to raise their voices. We need them to use their bully pulpit to say, this is not right. We need them to be asking to be able to see detention centers, to be saying no. So we work with Congress. What else do? We look for local and state electeds, because another amazing thing about the ACLU is that we have offices everywhere. We have affiliates everywhere. And so our affiliates in every single state of the United States are fighting against anti-immigrant policies. They're fighting against any anti-civil liberties and civil laws that are being passed. And so that's what advocacy means. Advocacy means using all of the tools in our toolkit to raise our voices and to fight back, because the only way we're going to be able to defeat this is by using every single tool in our toolkit.
That's right. That's right. Now, and one of the things that I think it's important to remind people of, and please talk about this, is the idea that, like, I think sometimes the news convinces you that something has been that way for a long time, and it sort of can wipe out the fact that history can move quickly and things can change quickly. And so this country has not always been, even in the recent past, as anti-immigrant, especially Southern immigrants from the global South, as it is now. Again, I keep referencing my TV show, United Shades, because that was where I went to college, was my television show. But I remember talking to people in Mexico about how people used to, like, live in Mexico, work in downtown Nogales, Arizona, go back home for lunch, go back to work at the end of the day. Like, there was just the border crossing used to not be a big deal in the way it is now. Whereas now you literally could not pull that off living in Mexico and working in America and going back and forth. So can you talk about, like, how we got here and when all this stuff shifted? So that people, because I think especially for a lot of the young people listening, they may just believe, like, this is the way it's always been.
Yeah, no, it's really important to note that part of the reason why we're here, or a huge reason why we're here, is because the anti-immigrant movement has spent millions and billions of dollars to change the narrative, to portray immigrants as something other than human. And so when you are being outspent, when they're spending billions and billions of dollars to project that narrative and other people are not, well, that's the narrative that takes hold, right? And so we have seen that. But to your point, yes, in the recent past, there was something called, for example, the Bracero program. And Bracero means arms. So they wanted immigrants' arms to be able to harvest the crops, because they understood that, you know, we need immigration. We know that immigration and people who are immigrants are good to the country. We also know, for example, that when we push back, we can win. For example, the DACA program, which is a program that is for undocumented people who came here as children, that was not won just because. It was won because it was fought by undocumented youth who were undocumented and unafraid and unapologetic. They said, we deserve to be in this country just like everybody else, because this is the only country that they know. And because they rose their voices, they went to the streets, they advocated on Capitol Hill, they advocated at the White House, then they were able to create this program, DACA, which has shown all the contributions that undocumented people bring to this country. And of course, we know, or just in case our listeners don't know, the DACA program is currently under attack also, because this is one of the things that I think is important for people to know, is that this administration is trying to find ways, or the anti-immigrant movement is trying to find ways to make people who are documented undocumented. Mm. And therefore, that way, they're going to be able to increase the numbers of people who are being deported. And that in itself is completely cruel. But I think it's important, just going back to your point, to note that there is another way. There is another vision that immigration does not have to be this way, because the reality is we have seen again and again, report after report, that it is because of people who are immigrants that our economy grows. It is because of people who are immigrants that we have not gone into a recession. So we know the value. And so just like we know with the economic value, we also know the value in our societies, in our communities, and we need to be able to talk about that. And so it is our responsibility, every single one of us who's listening to this right now, it is our responsibility to show that a different way is possible and that immigration is in fact something that is good for our nation.
Yeah, I love the way you put all that, because all the research that shows that immigrants are essential to the building of this country and essential to the thrival of this country, not just the survival, but immigrants open more businesses, they innovate because they come here because we've had a good press release saying that we're the place where dreams come true and the land of opportunity, and immigrants come here and often make those dreams come true. So the idea that immigration has been hyper-criminalized in a way that it did not used to be, that I think even the fact when I learned that crossing the border was a traffic ticket. It was not a thing that was sending you to jail in the way it is now, or making you be detained the way it is now.
Yeah, because immigration law is civil law. It doesn't fall under criminal law. But to your point, the right and the anti-immigrant movement, what they have tried to do is criminalize it. Make it more and more. So we saw it recently. There was a law that just passed this year that said, well, if you have been accused of something related to thefts, it could be shoplifting. If you have just merely been accused of shoplifting, now you mandatorily will be detained. That is the criminalization of our communities. What that does is that feeds into that detention pipeline so they can get more people out of here. That goes against our values. And under the U.S. values, we do not detain people and we do not incarcerate people just because they've been accused of something. What if I don't like you, come out, and now I accuse you of something, and now your whole life is mm-hmm. put in peril just because I didn't like you? That is not the way our justice system ought to work. I also want to say, for example, right now, one of the executive orders, the first executive order from this president, was taking away birthright citizenship from certain children who were born in this country. Number one, let's talk about that is unconstitutional. The Constitution of the United States provides that people who are born in the United States are U.S. citizens. Did this administration care about the constitutionality of that executive order? No. Now, let's think about, though, what does that mean in terms of the harm to our communities and our society? To have children who are second-class citizens, so some of them might even be stateless because they don't have anywhere to go because the countries of origins of their parents might not even accept them. That is not something that is good for us. It's not good for anybody, not for the children, not for the community, not for the nation. And so we need to really be thoughtful, and we need to talk about the positives of having children be able to incorporate into the United States and the fabric and be able to fulfill their aspirations. That is good for all of us. Having people be able to go to hospitals and courthouses, it is good for all of us. But again, another thing that has happened under this administration is they have said, well, although before we didn't go into courthouses and sensitive locations like churches, schools, hospitals to enforce immigration enforcement because it wasn't a good idea, well, now, because we're so cruel and because we don't care, we're going to go there. But again, that makes all of us less secure. That makes all of us less likely to thrive because now all of us are wondering, well, what's happening?
Yeah, and I think the thing you said that I really want to pin down is the idea of it's making documented people undocumented, or even, and I've seen some of these videos online, making people who are documented, treating them like they're undocumented, even though they know they're documented. And there's been videos of even just random citizens pulling over, and I'm using air quotes, pulling over people that they are assuming are undocumented, even though they don't have the right to do that, even if they are undocumented. And these people are actually citizens of this country, are here under legal status, but it is turning people into feeling like they are deputized citizens of this administration. Deputized sheriffs of this administration, what I'm trying to say.
Well, that goes to show, Kamau, the importance of what the rhetoric is, right? So if at the top you have people using hateful words against people who are immigrants, well, that empowers other people who feel like now they're emboldened and they can do whatever they want. And that is very dangerous. So that's why actions are important. Words are important. The way that our leadership treats people who are immigrants is important because that trickles down. And another example to what you said, we saw early with these mass raids that are happening, what we saw is we saw a U.S. citizen who is a veteran of the United States. He was caught in a raid. And when he said, I'm a veteran, here is my ID, they did not believe him. So to your point again, let's go back. This is affecting all of us. This is affecting people who are undocumented. This is people affecting people who are U.S. citizens. This is affecting all of us.
Yes. Can we talk a little more about the executive orders? What are the other executive orders that Trump has rolled out? And also, you know, if there's ways in which those executive orders, you know, are either unconstitutional or don't align with what he said when he was running for president, that would also be interesting to note.
Yeah, so we talked about the birthright citizenship executive order, which is unconstitutional because the U.S. Constitution provides for citizenship for people born in the United States. We also, another thing that he has done in terms of executive orders is he has expanded what is called expedited removal. What that really means is fast-track deportations. What that really means is that people no longer have access to present their case in front of a judge. Imagine, again, this whole idea of not allowing people to either have their day in court or have representation or really make use of law, that is just something that is illegal. That shouldn't be, but that is happening. So right now, that's what they're trying to do because they want to increase their numbers. They want to deport as many people as possible without giving them the right to present their case in court. So the ACLU is challenging that too. Another thing that the administration has done is they have pretty much ended the right to seek asylum at the border by closing the border. That, again, is illegal. Now, the law, both national and international law, allow for people to be able to come to the United States and present their case for asylum. But right now, that's no longer happening. So that's another thing that's happening. Another thing that's very interesting that we should all take note, because when we're talking about immigration, the American people want solutions. And so what is a solution? A solution is for people to, for example, be able to present their case and have their cases be heard accordingly. And for that, you need resources. But what did this administration do? Well, they have fired immigration judges. So we no longer have, as it was, we had a huge backlog of cases in immigration court. And that's what people were waiting for such a long time. Well, now with the firing of so many judges, imagine how long it's going to take. What else have they done? They have fired people working in immigration services. So again, this blinded idea of like, let's just focus on deporting people is really ignoring the people's rights and people's liberties to be able to present their cases in court.
And it, like you said, it also just creates such a culture of confusion, right? And just of like not knowing as a citizen who is an immigrant, where you can go and who you can trust and how to move around your city and your town. It's to me, so much of this is about creating chaos so that people can't ever get their bearings.
That is so true. It's definitely about creating chaos. I can tell you, I get calls all the time. I get calls from people saying ICE is on the subway. What do I do? Mm-hmm. So people can't even move from place to place because they're worried. The other day, I got a phone call from a friend of mine who's a psychologist. She works at a hospital. She said, my client just told me that she can't bring her child to her psychological appointment because she's afraid that something will happen. Mm-hmm. And we have seen some kids not going to school. We have seen people just retreating but that's what they're trying to create. They're trying to create chaos so that we cannot live our normal lives. And so that is why, and I'm going to now turn to the positive, come out, because this is really important. Knowing people's rights is really important. Mm. Knowing your individual rights is important, and also knowing the rights of people around you. Because if you are somebody who is not personally impacted, but you have some sort of privilege, you can exert your rights, because by you exerting your rights, you're helping other people exert the rights, right? Well, it's important for them to know the difference between public areas and private areas, right? Because public spaces, in public spaces, well, people, you know, ICE can come in, they can be hanging around, but that's not the case in a private space. In a private space, you have to ask for permission. You have to ask for consent or have a judicial warrant. So as a business owner, if I were a business owner, what I should be doing is clearly demarcating what is a public space, what is a private space, making sure that when anybody tries to enter a private space, I say, I do not consent. You do not have my permission to do this. Ask for a judicial warrant and then look at the document, because this is also something very important, that often what we see is the immigration services provide a document that looks official, but it's not a judicial warrant. Here are some tips to identify a judicial warrant. Is it signed by a judge? Is it issued by a court, whether a state court, a federal court? If it's issued by the Department of Homeland Security, if it says immigration, it is likely not a judicial warrant. So we have that information, and I want to make sure that people know we have that information on our webpage about knowing your rights. Just go to our webpage. The other thing that I want people to know is we are doing Know Your Rights trainings consistently. Every 2 weeks, we're having Know Your Rights trainings. You have any questions, you don't know what your rights are, come to us, because I want to make sure that it's very clear for everybody. You have the right to inform yourself, to inform other people, and to exert those constitutional rights that we all have by being in the United States.
Well, first of all, thank you for giving us some action plans. I appreciate that. I appreciate some, like, you know, like, and I do appreciate the reminder that those of us who are not directly affected doesn't mean we're not in this with our communities. And it doesn't mean that we can't use our privilege that we have in one area to help someone who doesn't have privilege in that area. First of all, I hate to tell you this, but you sound pretty woke to me. So I don't know. If
I hate to tell you. I am awake and I am fighting. That's nice. What I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
And I am resilient, just like my community. And we're not backing down, because we know our rights. We know that the Constitution allows for me to be here. It allows for me to share this information. It allows for me to use my privilege. And so I am awake. I am eyes wide open, and I know that I can do this, and I will continue to do so, even if other people don't like it.
Whew, that's called a mic drop, everybody. I don't know what else to say about that. If I was a comedian, I wouldn't want to follow that on stage. If you had just done that, I'd been like, put somebody else up. I'm not following that. let's take a break for a moment. The crowd's too raucous after that mic drop. And I think my favorite part of this interview, Maribel, is in the middle, you sort of stuck in the fact that, like, if I didn't like you, Kamau, and you said a bunch of things, I was like, oh, that means she likes me. So I was like, I just wanted to make sure I heard that. That means that she likes me, which I appreciate.
I want to make clear, Kamau, I like you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being in this fight with us. And it's going to take all of us. So thank you for being behind that mic and asking these very important questions so that our people know what we're doing. Thank you. And yes, I like you. I hope you like me too.
I like you. We like each other.
All right.
Thank you. All right, Maribel, if you can hang tight for a beat, I'm going to come back to you and have some final questions. Does that sound right for you?
You got it.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you. Here to help us think through the legal aspect of immigration rights is a lawyer at the ACLU's national office in New York City and the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. Please welcome to the show, Lee Gallant. Hello, Lee. Nice to officially meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you, finally.
Thank you for doing this. I know. Not only do I know you're a busy person, you have the look and feel of a busy person. That's the vibe I'm getting right now off of you. Is that the correct vibe?
Absolutely. That's what my mom says every time I'm on TV. Why do you look so tired?
Well, I know not to say tired, because I hear that too from my mom whenever I'm on TV. And I'm like, what would you expect? But yeah, you have that feeling of like, the minute this podcast is over, I have a million things to do.
Yeah.
First of all, I'm going to ask the hardest question I'll ask. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. You know, I think I've been at the ACLU now over 3 decades, and there's been ups and downs all the time. And, you know, whenever I get really tired or discouraged or feel like it's all futile. I just think about the clients who I've met and they're going to meet. You know, they are persevering. They are fighting for their lives. And I don't really have the luxury of saying, well, I'm tired, or I think it's, I don't want to keep fighting, you know, or it's all useless. Mm-hmm. If I can help even one family, it's worth it. So I just don't feel like I ever have the luxury of saying I'm going to quit on this.
Yeah, I'm somewhat similar. When in my mind, whenever I'm like, man, this is sure hard work I'm doing, the ghost of Harriet Tubman shows up and is like, I'm sorry, what? You said it's hard?
Right, exactly.
Oh, you're struggling? Oh, you're having a hard time? So yeah. That perspective is important for those of us who have the, I don't know, good fortune to be in a position to help folks, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I look at it is, you know, I would rather be doing something and feel privileged to be at the ACLU and be in a position to try and do something. So, yeah, I think I'm with you on that.
Yeah. How did you end up as someone who, I mean, you know, you can get a law degree in lots of things. How did this end up being where you ended up at the ACLU and also dealing with immigration law?
Yeah, that's interesting. I always knew I wanted to do social justice and public interest work, you know, and I went to law school knowing that. But when I came out of law school, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, immigration really wasn't as big an issue back then. And I thought I was going to do what was considered sort of more standard civil rights work. I had done criminal defense work, some death penalty work, discrimination work, all those things that I sort of, segregation work, all those things that I sort of thought of as more classic civil rights issues. And I remember this job opened up at the ACLU and I thought, well, you know, I don't really know anything about immigration. I wasn't looking to do immigration work, but it fit my criteria because it was about race and poverty, I felt. And I still feel that's what basically immigration is about, is race and poverty. And those were my two criteria for what I wanted to do. You know, and I remember a good friend of mine at law school was also going to do public interest, saying, don't go do immigration. That's backwater. No one will ever hear from you again. You know, and obviously it's turned into one of, if not the biggest hot button issue. But yeah, I thought I was going to come to the ACLU and do immigrants' rights work for a few years and then move on. One thing led to another, and now here I am. So I always sort of try to tell young people, don't plot out your life too carefully. Just, you know, be open to where it takes you. And this is where it's taken me.
So you've been there long enough that the ACLU, the L stands for Lee. Is that what I hear is correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm walking around now and I only see a few people that started with me, but
yeah,
it is what it is.
Yeah, and I'm sure I would imagine all those young people appreciate all that knowledge you have and institutional knowledge of having been there this long.
Yeah, and they also look at me like, who is this old guy, you know, but it all comes with the territory.
Yeah, if we're lucky, we all get to who is this old person around here. I think that's where you have to look at it, too.
You know, and they think I don't know anything about anything, so... You know, a few years ago during the family separation crisis, Spike Lee was doing a documentary for HBO and asked if I would come down and film part of it. And, you know, I put my paralegal on the thread so we'd help deal with logistics. And just to see how much they thought I was clueless about everything, I just sent an email saying, who's Spike Lee? Thinking... They wrote back a 3-page email. His name is Spike Lee. And I was like, really? Do you think I'm that?
That's funny.
Yeah. So, you know, it's sort of an interesting mix now being the old one there.
Yeah. Well, as a fellow old one, I appreciate the old ones.
Like, so right
there with you. So talking about immigration, as you said, it's like a hot button issue. I was just talking to Mary Bell about it.
Yeah.
And the idea that, like, immigration didn't used to be such a big deal. We weren't, not that we were always the best country to immigrants, but we weren't demonizing and criminalizing them the way we are now.
Yeah.
And so as someone who's in the middle of it now, are there key terms you think people are confused about that we should clear up or things that people don't know about that they should hear about when we're talking about immigration?
Yeah. I mean, so I think, you know, you're right to point out the sort of arc of how the country has treated immigrants. I mean, it has been cyclical. There have been some bad periods in our time, starting with how we treated the Chinese, then throughout various periods. In my 30 plus years being at the ACLU, this is by far the worst. It just feels like people are struggling to be as mean-spirited as they can toward immigrants. It's like there's like a fever going on that hopefully is going to break at some point. But I do think people are misunderstanding a few things. I mean, one is the whole notion of asylum. You know, asylum, we said after World War II, we would never send people back to danger without at least screening them to see if they would be persecuted or tortured when sent back. And I think people think, well, if you come here and you don't have a visa in advance, why should you be allowed to come here? But the whole point of asylum is you're fleeing and you need to flee quickly and get here. And it doesn't mean everyone's entitled to asylum, but the idea that we're not even going to screen people anymore is just so antithetical to our history and our values and the solemn commitment we made after World War II. I think people are forgetting that, because right now what President Trump has done is cut off all pathways, absolutely all pathways to apply for asylum. The other thing I think that people are really misapprehending is that the president is only going after criminal aliens, as he calls them. You know, I mean, we think that even if you have a criminal conviction, you're entitled to certain rights, including a fair hearing. And yes, coming here without advance permission and without asylum is a misdemeanor. But, you know, our country has lots of people like that. They've been here for years. They're contributing. And it doesn't mean that they may not have committed the misdemeanor or overstayed their visa, which is not even a crime. But it's just some amount of humane discretion has to be exercised. I mean, the immigration laws are extremely harsh. So if you wanted to enforce them to the hilt, you could be deporting parents who have been here 25 years, contributing, their children are U.S. citizens, they have no crimes. And the only reason it hasn't been comparatively that harsh in the past is because both Democratic and Republican presidents have exercised some amount of humane discretion. But now you have President Trump coming in, acting as if he's only going after the worst of the worst. But the truth is, they're going to be starting to round up, and already have rounded up, people with no criminal convictions. And, you know, even beyond just the humanity of it, I don't know why businesses are not pushing back. I mean, there is no way that our economy can function with if you're going to deport 10 million immigrants. And I think also mayors, both Democratic and Republican, who are in small cities, big cities or small cities, towns, who have been revitalized by immigrants, you know, they don't have time for the ideological nonsense. They just need to get their city or town running. And they know that immigrants are beneficial. And so they need to step up as well. So I think, you know, those are a few things that are on my mind. And I am hopeful that the American public will push back. You know, when I was doing the family separation case, the first Trump administration, I think that the president had thought he had dehumanized immigrants to such an extent that he could literally do anything. But when he started taking away babies and toddlers, everyone came out. Progressive, conservative, Democrat, or Republican. I had so many people come up to me and say, you know, I'm a conservative. I don't believe in virtually anything the ACLU does, but this is just a bridge too far. Little babies and toddlers being taken away. I think we need to document what is happening now, because I think when people voted for mass deportations or strict immigration enforcement, they were voting for something that was too abstract and vague for them to understand what it meant in practice. We're going to need to document for people what this actually looks like in practice. And I'm hopeful when the American public sees it, they'll say, well, that's not what you were talking about in the campaign. But, you know, we'll see how this plays out. But we do need to make sure that we're not just fighting in court. And we have to be clear-eyed that we can't win everything in court. And any civil rights lawyer will tell you the courts are not 100% the 100% answer. We need the public to push back just like they did in family separation.
Yeah, I hear some of you're getting alerts on your phone, your computer. I'm sure those are important emails if you need to leave at any point. So in one of the earlier episodes this year, I spoke to Cecilia Wong right after the election, you know, ACLU legal director. And she showed me this giant book of they showed me the cover that said Trump memos of how the ACLU was planning to respond to the incoming administration. Now that we're here and he sort of has gone executive action frenzy, are all of these things you're like, yeah, we knew that was coming? Has anything surprised you?
I think we did a good job, unlike the first time around where it caught us by surprise, caught a lot of people by surprise. I think we did a good job of preparing for just about everything. But a lot of the main things we thought he would do, he's done, and we've already filed lawsuits. So we have immediately filed a lawsuit about him sending immigrants to Guantanamo. We have filed a lawsuit about him trying to take away due process for people in the interior of the country. He wants to say, if you can't prove on the spot you've been here longer than 2 years, you can be removed solely based on a supervisor's signature in 24 hours, no matter, you could be anywhere in the country. We have pushed back on his border policy, eliminating all pathways to asylum. We have pushed back on birthright citizenship, and there are gonna be many, many more lawsuits to go. We'll see how the courts react to them. There's a lot of talk about how the courts have abandoned us. I'm not one of those people that has given up on the federal courts. I think federal judges, no matter who has appointed them, take their job very, very seriously. And I think we're already seeing federal judges, no matter who has appointed them, pushing back. I think if we come with the right arguments, I am still hopeful the courts will help us. It won't be every suit, but I'm still hopeful. But, you know, to your question, it's been way worse than Trump won. There are so many things. They're literally just going through the United States Code and seeing what provisions they can use and creating overlapping policies so that we're going to basically have to play whack-a-mole. We're going to have to win everyone. Like at the border, there's like five different policies now that do the same thing. And they're just going to force us to win every lawsuit. And, you know, and we'll keep trying. But I think it's more the speed and aggressiveness that they've shown, especially in court, where they will not budge on anything that they, things they used to budge on during Trump won, that's more surprised us than what they've done. I think we did a pretty good job of preparing for what they would do.
No, and I mean, I think that I was surprised by the birthright citizenship one out of the gate, because it's, you know, for an administration that claims to love the Constitution and the rule of law, to just right. come straight out and say we're disrespecting the Constitution was really, I guess not surprising, but just like it was a clear indicator of how disruptive they want to be and how quickly.
Oh, absolutely. But what's interesting now, I think, is that every district court now so far has struck down the executive order barring birthright citizenship, except for people who have a lawful permanent resident or citizen parent. But the government has not done what they usually do and moved it quickly to the Supreme Court. I think that they know they're on thin legal ice. And so they don't want this to be the first case that hits the Supreme Court. And so that's a sort of interesting thing to keep an eye on is, you know, did they do this for performative reasons, but know that this is not their first move to the Supreme Court?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And I believe, wasn't it, I saw in some case it was actually a Trump-appointed judge who struck it down? Is that a thing? Am I right about that?
You know, I'd have to go back and look at all the different judges, but I don't think...
You don't remember everything that's happened in the last month?
Exactly. I mean, that's when you know there's too much going on is when we can't even keep track. And so we're, you know, sometimes I see people get on and start talking about nuance and the weeds. And I'm like, well, how is the American public going to really, we can't even keep track of it all. And I think that's one of the challenges for us is how to talk about it at a level that the American public can understand. That's why I appreciated your first question of like, sort of, what don't we understand about all these terms? Because immigration's complex, all this legal mumbo jumbo is complex. And at some point we need to just pull back and, you know, be able to talk to the American public in a way that they understand.
You know, immigration is such a complicated and complex series of things, like, you know, mixed status family. I think that's right. One thing I learned early on is that we sort of think documented, not documented, and really understanding that, like, no, many families, or not most immigrants' family, have mixed status people involved.
Right.
And so, and, you know, again, I appreciate you saying you can't sort of, you don't want anybody to listen to this and think, oh, that's advice for me personally.
Right.
Because this is every immigrant situation is different.
Right.
Would you say there are factors that contribute to someone's level of vulnerability so that, you know, that if this is your case, this is your country of origin versus this, or this is your status, like things that are sort of more, you know, as you say, more reasons for the administration to target you?
Well, I think there's certain countries and we all know which ones they're going after, you know, and generally countries, people of color. You know, there's a lot of hipsters in Brooklyn who've overstayed their visa. We don't really see them being targeted from, you know, Western European countries. I would say that if you have a criminal conviction in your past, no matter how minor, you need to be concerned. If you're come recently, you need to be concerned. You know, and one of the things that we are trying to navigate, which we're finding very difficult, at least I am, is that proper balance between alerting people to what could be coming, but not panicking them so that they really become paralyzed by fear.
Yeah.
You know, because not every immigrant's going to be targeted. I'm getting calls from people who say, I have no criminal convictions. I'm a lawful permanent resident. I've been here 20 years. I served in the military. Should I be worried? You know, generally speaking, no. But you, so you don't, you have to be very careful, I think, of overly panicking immigrant communities, but giving them sound advice. That's where I think at the local level, it's so important that community groups, churches, grassroots organizers are really talking to people on a very personal level about what's going on, because it's very easy to watch the news and feel like I literally can't go out of my house. You know, and there, for some people that may be true. And again, you know, I don't want to have to say one size fits all, because this is a scary moment. I'm getting calls from teachers all around the country. Kids are not coming to school. Their parents don't want them to come. They're too scared. And so this is not to minimize how bad things are, but we also have to make sure that we don't, you know, make people so fearful that they literally, and there's no easy answer. And people, you know, again, I know this, I'm repeating myself, but people are going to have to make decisions for themselves, and it may turn on, or do they have U.S. citizen children, how young their children are, all those types of decisions. Yeah.
No, I think it's great to repeat yourself, because it lets us know how important and how clear these things are. So please feel free to repeat yourself as many times as you need, because I think it is confusing. And I think one of the things, as you know, that the Trump administration is doing is just flooding the zone with just all sorts of things to make it intentionally confusing, to create chaos. So I think it's good to hear.
Exactly. Yeah, intentionally creating chaos, but intentionally trying to scare people. And so how often they're going to go after people at churches or schools or hospitals or courthouses, who knows? But just putting that fear out there is having a devastating effect on immigrant communities. The same thing with Guantanamo. You now are hearing from immigrants who won't be sent to Guantanamo, I don't think, or could be, but everyone's just so fearful. And now what you have are agents saying to people, well, if you don't accept going to Mexico, even though Mexico is not your home country, we're sending you to Guantanamo. So there's so much about just creating fear that's really troubling.
And you said, you mentioned earlier about having a Know Your Rights pamphlet, just so you can have a sense of what your rights are. And also, like you said, the idea of, like, if you know you have a conviction, even no matter how minor the conviction is, just be more aware of it in a way that you didn't have to be aware under previous administrations. Are there any other ways that you think vulnerable people can really sort of actively protect themselves, like what they're carrying or what they're not carrying, or what they tell people or what they don't tell people in their family?
Yeah, I mean, I think people need to carry their documents now. If they're here lawfully, to carry their documents. We're also telling people who may not be here lawfully but want to apply for asylum to carry utility bills to show how long they've been here. Because one of the things that they're doing is saying, if you can't prove on the spot you've been here longer than 2 years, we're going to do what's called expedited removal on you, meaning they can just have a supervisor sign off, no judge, no hearing, no anything. And so, you know, I don't even know whether the ICE agents will accept the utility bill. I mean, that's one of the things why we're going to court about this, that there's no due process. But while the policy is in place, we're telling people, carry something that shows how long you've been here. You know, that's how bad it is. It doesn't mean that you can't still be deported, but at least you'll get a hearing. I mean, that's sort of how bad things have gotten, is we're now just fighting to have hearings. You know, in the United States, that should be unthinkable, that you wouldn't give someone a hearing where their whole life is at stake. And yet that's what they want to do. And it used to be that you didn't get a hearing all the time at the border. And we fought that and fought that. We've sort of lost that battle of whether they can do what that expedited removal at the border, you know, and that's been bad enough. And it's caused a lot of erroneous removals, including even U.S. citizens. But now the Trump administration is the first administration that's ever bringing that lack of due process into the interior of the country. So you can be sitting at a diner in Iowa, they come up to you, you know, maybe you look Latino to them and say, show us your papers. Can you prove you've been here longer than 2 years? If not, you're gone based on a supervisor's signature. Poof. And so we're also telling families, you got to make sure you have somewhere for your kids to go. If you're just pulled out of work or pulled off the street and removed, maybe power of attorney agreements, carry a phone number, all those types of things. I mean, that's what it's come to in the United States.
I mean, you know, just the fact that you say carry your papers with you, you can't help but think of like apartheid South Africa or Nazi Germany. Like the idea that like we're at a place of like carry your papers with you is shocking in some sense, but also totally reasonable, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, you put it well before, this is how many things they're doing, sowing chaos and creating an atmosphere where no one even knows what to respond to at any given moment, and everything just becomes normalized. And that's what we really need to fight against, is ever just becoming sort of complacent about it.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is when you say carry your papers, I know there have been times in my life where, you know, as a black man, somebody has asked me like, oh, do you have your ID on you? And I'm like, I always have my ID on me. Right. Like I'm not an immigrant. I believe I have birthright citizenship for now. But like, even as a black man in this country, I don't leave my house without ID on me. You know what I mean? Right. Like, so there's a sense of like, there's the rules and the law, but then, you know, as a vulnerable member of a vulnerable community, you have to operate by a different set of rules and law.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And what's interesting about it, I think, the American public is they've bought into this narrative, or a lot of people have, of President Trump talking about immigrants in the aggregate. And what I always tell people is, think about the immigrants you know personally. Do they actually fit the characterization you hear from President Trump? You know, people say, oh, yeah, that's true, that, you know, my next door neighbor is an immigrant, or the person who works in my office, or the custodian in my son's school. And then I get a lot of, well, they wouldn't go after that person. And then 4 weeks later, I get the call and say, I can't believe it. The custodian in my son's school is the nicest guy. I didn't think that's who they meant they were going to go after. Yeah. You know, so it's bad. As much as I don't want to panic people, I will say that it's bad. This is, you know.
I can see that you feel bad saying it's bad, but as someone who has your resume and worked at the ACLU for 30 years, I think we should really take it seriously that you're saying it's bad. Like, so I don't think that, I think it, you know, one of my favorite quotes that is my friend taught me in high school, if all around you have lost your head and you've kept yours, you've clearly misunderstood the situation. So
that's a great quote.
Yeah, so like the idea of being like, you know, sometimes it is time to panic and you're not panicking, but it is time to sound the alarm. It's time to sound the alarm and go, this is real. This is really happening. And if you're not careful, it's going to come to your front door.
Yeah, for
sure. Even if you are careful, it's going to come to your front door.
And yeah, and you know what I also think is that sometimes people think problems are so big, they overwhelm them, that they sort of say, what can I do? I can't really do anything. But the truth is, every little thing matters. And you go out and do something, someone else says, oh, that person's doing something. And it leads to more and more activity, especially like sort of young. I've been going around to law schools recently and talking to law students, because I feel like the level of energy is so much less than during Trump won. And I think people are burnt out. They think it's futile. They just have accepted it. And trying to get them to realize, like, okay, maybe you can't solve every problem, but just help one family, you know, do one thing. And I think people need to realize that, not get overwhelmed by how big the problems are, and just do something, you know, even if it's just being nice to one immigrant family matters. But there is this sense of when the problems are so many and so big, well, what can I do? But people can do stuff, you know, and you get out there and be in a protest, your next door neighbor says, oh, I'll go, you know, and it just leads to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you've been doing out there doing this for a long time, and, you know, it has to start somewhere.
Yeah, and I think we're at a time where those of us who already do this work have to do a little more, and those of us who've been doing nothing have to do something. You know, it's just the nature of the game. We all have to sort of step it up.
Yeah.
You said again about, like, if you're not a person who is an immigrant or has immigrants in your family, but you're, of course, we're all in communities of immigrants, whether we know it or not.
Right.
And you want to help. Is there, you know, what can you do if you know someone's being held by ICE or being deported, or if they show up at your office looking for immigrants and or the hospital or a school? Is there things you would recommend people to do and they're not an immigrant?
The best thing is probably to hook up with whoever is doing that work in your community, because things often get very localized. You know, people can reach out to the ACLU nationally, but I do think the ACLU state affiliates, but even more local than that, you know, who are the groups that are doing this kind of work? Are there legal organizations there? Is there a church? Those kind of things, to immediately make those phone calls and say, hey, I saw this happen. Is there anybody who can help this family? If you're a lawyer, then maybe you can sort of directly do it. But otherwise, I think to reach out to local groups and say, hey, someone was just arrested. Is there something we can do?
And I think probably, and related to that, is maybe make those phone calls before ICE shows up, you know, so you can have some preparation in advance. Right?
Well, that's exactly right. It's, you know, once ICE comes, it can be tricky to undo things. But I do think people want to know who are the groups in their community that are working on these issues. And so what is the preparation that's worthwhile in their local community? You know, sometimes it'll be national, but sometimes it'll just be like, what are the things in this local community I should know in advance? And so I think we are encouraging groups on the local level to make sure they're out there in the immigrant communities, and so many of them are, letting them know, here's a number for you to call, here are things you can do to prepare, those kinds of things.
So, Lee, what do you do for fun? I need to know what you do when you're not saving America from targeting immigrants. So what do you do to relax?
You know, this is going to sound boring, but it's 99.9% sports.
No, that's not boring. you're allowed to like sports.
I don't know if you know,
sports is pretty popular.
Yeah, no, I know. I watch a lot of sports and hang out with my kids and obviously my wife, but not so much the sports with my wife. Watch a lot of shows, watch your shows.
What's your sport? Yeah. What's the sport? Are you a baseball guy?
Basketball and football mainly.
Okay.
And I very much like college football. I grew up I played basketball in college with a small school. But I love college football. And I grew up in New York City, and no one likes college football in New York City. So then when I finally had boys, now every year we go to a different iconic college football stadium.
Oh, nice.
And do whatever there is to do in that area. So when we went down to an Alabama game, we went on the Civil Rights Tour, went to Selma. We just went to Mississippi and then did Memphis and all the history in Memphis, including the music. And so watch a lot of sports.
And, you know, let's be clear, professional sports in this country would be different if we didn't have immigrants who came to this country and then played professional sports. So like you don't have like a secret sports blog somewhere where you write about sports in your off time.
You know, I wish that I did. My sons would be too embarrassed if I started like, you know, blogging about sports, but I'm dying for some sports show to invite me on, you know, that wants to sort of talk sports and civil rights. Maybe you and I at some other life will have a podcast called Civil Rights and Sports.
Civil Rights and Hockey Fights. I don't know.
That's a good one.
So I asked both Lee and Mary Bell to reflect on this moment and to help us all put together a knowledge and action plan. Here's what they shared, and I'm sure I'll be calling on them both for another round of conversation before long. If listeners remember one thing from this conversation, what should it be?
Know your rights. How do you know your rights? Go to the ACLU's webpage. We have it in writing. We have it via videos, and we also have trainings. So use the best mode of learning for you, but know your rights, know your community's rights, and exercise them.
I think it's to get involved. No matter how small it is, get involved. It will be gratifying to you and it'll be helpful. Even at the level of being nice to an immigrant family, tutor a young kid in you know, help them with their English. If you're a lawyer, take a case. If you're not a lawyer, volunteer to translate, do some, to join a protest, anything. I think that's what I would say is don't let the magnitude of the problems deter you from just getting involved in any small way, and to always, always try and think of immigrants on an individual level, the immigrants you know, and to not let aggregate statistics and abstract policies blur the human dimension of what's going on.
If listeners do one thing after this conversation, what should it be?
Go to our webpage, aclu.org, know your rights, and learn everything that the U.S. Constitution protects you from.
Okay, what is giving you hope right now?
You know, partly what I said before about just how resilient the clients are, that the clients don't give up, that the families don't give up. I think that gives me hope that they have not given up on themselves. The other thing I think is just probably how long I've been doing this. I've seen ups and downs, and I've seen it get dark. And obviously, this may be the darkest of the moments. But I do think things will turn around, but not unless we keep pushing. But I think that's part of it.
What is giving me hope is seeing my family as we are holding on to each other and we're loving on each other, because our love is never going to end. My family, whether here or elsewhere, we're going to still be a family. And what is giving me hope is seeing my community. I see people at restaurants, people at church, people just on the street asking me, what can I do? It's giving me hope to know that we are all in this together and we're all trying to figure out what to do. Now, one person might not be able to do it all, but each one of us can do something to protect ourselves.
Absolutely. I feel the same way by looking at my family and just being like, we're all in this together. And also, I think you probably feel the same way too, is that like you want to be the example that your family can sort of be like, our family does this work. Our family fights for people who need fighters. Our family does this work in the world. I feel that all the time about like for my three daughters. I want you to see me out there so you know this is what we do, you know.
Yeah.
Where can listeners keep up with you and your work?
The ACLU has a lot of outlets, and I think, you know, there's all the media we do, there's the social stuff we put out, all that type of stuff. You know, there's, I think the ACLU website and social media outlets are probably the best place.
So the best way to keep up with me is aclu.org. You know, there you will see whether it is a podcast that I do, whether it's an interview that I do. That's where all my information is.
First of all, I got to appreciate, you know the brand. Everything I ask you, you're like, ACLU.org. Maribel, what do you want for breakfast? ACLU.org. Maribel, did you see the Super Bowl? ACLU.org. You are on brand messaging.
Okay, you can put some blueberries on my breakfast. ACLU.org blueberries, with blueberries.
Blueberries, okay. Good, good, good. You are not missing an opportunity to promote the brand. You're like a rapper with their record label. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for listening. And remember, friends, friends help friends stay in the fight. Join us. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. It really means a lot to us. Give us 5 stars. We're doing the big work here. Until next time, I'm your host, W. Kamau Bell. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU. This episode was executive produced by the ACLU's Jessica Herman-Weitz and Gwen Schroeder and Who Knows Best Productions, me, Kelly Rafferty, PhD, and Melissa Hudson-Bell, PhD, and was recorded at the Great Skyline Studios in Oakland, California. What's up, Brian? This show is edited and produced by Erica Ghetto and Mariah Gossett for Good Gift.